You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I'm Anthony Richter, Associate Director of the Open Society Institute, and I'm also a member of the board of the Revenue Watch Institute, and it's OSI and the Revenue Watch Institute, which are pleased today to welcome an old friend, Steve Levine, who has written this substantial book, The Oil and the Glory, The Pursuit of Empire and Fortune of the Caspian Sea. Steve and I were trying to recall exactly when we met. It was somewhere in the mid-1990s when he was out, as he describes in the book, working for a variety of major mainstream publications. He's going to talk about himself and in the course, I'm sure, of his introduction. And so it's great to have him here as an old friend and somebody who has watched the development of the hydrocarbon industry in the Caspian Basin up close. We looked at it also at the same time, came out with somewhat different, if not conclusions, but we kind of developed this whole Caspian Revenue Watch project, which later became the Revenue Watch Institute, based on drawing conclusions from the processes which are detailed with so well in Steve's book. So I've just figured out there's going to be a kind of a slide show either before or during the Steve's presentation, but I'd like to, all of you to welcome Steve, and he'll tell us a little bit about himself and talk about the book, and then we'll open it up for Q&A to all of you.
Great, thanks. Hi, I'm really glad to be here. Is this working well? Everyone can hear me? Great. The last time I was here at OSI was 1999, and Anthony made a big deal about the fact that I had just come from covering whatever war out there, and my mother was in the audience. I just wanted to point out that this time Anthony's mother is in the audience, right over here. I don't know from what shelter he's seeking. Okay, I will. I've tailored the talk a bit because you know, this group knows all the generalities of the place, and so I'm gonna skip that part. I will talk about myself just briefly, and then just go right into it. I was based in the Caucasus in Central Asia for 11 years. I arrived 3 weeks after the breakup of the Soviet Union in January 1992, and then stayed on through there through 2003. I went on to Stanford to write this book. Was there for 2 years, and now I'm based in Dallas, another foreign posting.
Okay. Especially after writing this book, you must. Feel like a foreigner in Texas.
Yeah. Well, a lot of Republicans there. You know, when we all arrived there, I think Anthony and I reckoned that we had met in 95 or so, 94, 95, just as he was trying to set up the Tashkent office where I had an office with BBC at that time. One of the things we were doing was running into a lot of other people who just arrived, and there wasn't really much known deep about the whole region. When I mean the whole, I'm talking Caucasus, Central Asia. I set up in Tbilisi and set up in Tashkent. And we were running into these oil men as well. And we you know, in our office, I mean, we couldn't even find a pencil to buy, or to buy desks, we had to bribe a school to give us some of their desks and a kitchen table. We rented the kitchen table from one of the people we hired on the staff, Malik, the driver, $25 per year for that table. And one of the first diplomats in Baku was a guy named Robert Finn. Did you know Finn?
Yeah, he was later ambassador in Kabul, the
right.
First one after the Taliban were overthrown. I was at his swearing in there.
So he's a very funny guy. Yeah, so he gave this very nice description of what it was like for these first people who arrived, and he was describing how when he arrived in Baku, there simply was no place to live of the type that diplomats like he were used to. And the place that he got a $60 a month apartment. And the way he described it was that the rats had the kitchen, I had the bedroom. And then later, that was when it was already clear when I interviewed him how important the region had become. And I talked to his DCM, Philip Remler, about and told him about Finn's remark. And Remler said, Finn stole that story. I was the one with the rats. So the oil men who came arrived to resistance from Russia, of course, and the way that at first manifested itself was in the following way. It was these oil guys would, you know, be in their hotel rooms and casually walk by a portrait on the wall and notice a wire running from it and look behind that portrait, and there would be a microphone in the offices that they took in Almaty and in Baku. They were all suspicious of each other, of course, because there was so much on the line, and so they would have bug sweepers and they would sweep their offices just in case. And every single day, at the end of the day, they would sweep, take out the microphones, arrive the next morning, sweep again, the microphones would be back. At night, what they discovered was that the KGB, or the local successor agencies, would dig holes in the walls and put these microphones back and then cover them over with plaster. This created such an atmosphere of suspicion and paranoia that the oil men would go to great lengths not to be surveilled. And the British ambassador at that time told me about how, in Baku, told me about how once he and the local BP man wanted to have a very sensitive discussion. They were not going to hold this discussion in their office. And so they walked out onto the seashore, and they figured what with the waves and so forth, that no one was going to hear them. And so they're walking along the seashore having this discussion. And they notice that as they're walking, a car is following them and parks, and a dog jumps out. And as they're walking, the dog is following them. And every time they say something, the dog's tail is going up. What are these dastardly Russians up to this time? And they just went back to the office. And I asked this fellow, Roger Thomas is his name. What did you really think? Did you actually think that you were being bugged? It was possible with his dog, and even if so, how would they make the dog's tail rise every time you spoke? He says, "Who knew?" was his reply. These oil men who arrived, the diplomats who arrived, they were dealing with a type of local negotiator who they hadn't met, they hadn't encountered anywhere in the world. There was a fellow named Murat Manafov, for example, in Baku. Did you run into Marat?
He wasn't part of my repertoire.
He wasn't. He wasn't there. Okay. Manafov became the Azeri lead negotiator at one time. And at his introductory meeting, he was with all these oil men, and he said, okay, let's introduce each other, let's become acquainted, let's pass out our business cards. And so you have this long room of these oil lawyers and negotiators and so forth handing out their business cards. And it comes around the table, and it comes to Manafov himself, and he reaches into his jacket, and he pulls out a 9mm pistol, and he slaps it on the table. This was his calling card. The you had these oil men, you had these diplomats. They were interesting guys. You were watching history unfold before your eyes. Those who knew, who had read Peter Hopkirk's works, realized the parallels between then and now, and the oil men and the diplomats themselves were very excited about this, as were the journalists. But in my view, these fellows were not the most interesting of the characters who we met. It was the entrepreneurs. There were a set of individuals, very powerful individuals, who arrived on the Caspian under their own steam, not linked to any company or country really, who managed to insinuate themselves in the very biggest deals on both sides of the Caspian and into the palaces in Baku, Almaty, and Moscow too. And the diplomats and the oil men were forced to deal with these guys. John Doyce was one of them. John Doyce was a Dutch oil man who had gained a long reputation around the world for being a very sharp and talented and wealthy businessman. But when he arrived on the Caspian, he raised a lot of suspicions. He arrived there, and one thing people noticed about him was a physical thing. He had this scar running down the whole back of his neck, and this unexplained. What was this all about? And why was the KGB tailing him all across Europe? What was this thing about this $100 million debt that he owed somebody? Why did he arrive on the Caspian not as the Dutchman he was, but as the official representative of the Sultanate of Oman? Doyce had a capacity, this kind of genius, for being able to walk into any room, no matter who was inside that room, no matter how important the people were in that room, and make those people think that he was important. And those people, whether they were the president, the prime minister, or businessmen, wanted to deal with him exclusively. And he ended up having control over two giant oil deals in Kazakhstan. Jim Giffen was the biggest personality of this type of the era. He like Doyce, started out with humble roots. He's from California. He went to Berkeley to college. While he was at Berkeley, he met and married the granddaughter of Harry Hopkins, FDR's intimate, and used this marriage as an entree. Hey, Bill, it's my former boss. You can't check up on me this time. Okay. Used this entree into society along with this personality trait he had, kind of a similar trait to Doyce's, and that was this genius again for making older, very powerful men like him and want to mentor him and really want to have him as their aide, their closest aide. And he used these two facts, this personality and his membership now in American aristocracy, to launch himself into a prized position as a negotiator, a deal maker inside the Kremlin during the first days of détente, 1969, 1970, and 1971. It was an amazing position that he had as a very young man. He was in his 20s, and he became a millionaire from this. He stayed in this position. He kept it throughout the 70s, throughout the 80s. When the Soviet Union fell apart, he lost this position. He lost his contacts. He lost everything. Went on to Kazakhstan and became the chief oil advisor to the president. During the mid-1990s, the mid and the late 1990s, actually, Giffen controlled the biggest oil deals in the whole world. He was the gatekeeper for these deals, and the oil men came to detest him. They said he was an arrogant man, which was a lot if anyone here knows any oil men. These oil deals were all eventually done on both sides of the Caspian. I think, wait, what do I got here? Okay. Just checking on my maps. The oil deals were all completed on the Azerbaijan side of the Caspian, on the Kazakhstan side. This opened the real struggle, and the struggle was, how do we get this oil out? Oil in the ground is worth nothing. And the difference between the Caspian region and the Middle East or the African region is that the oil fields are located in places very far from the sea. So began this struggle, this geopolitical struggle, to develop pipelines coming out of that region. When Bill Clinton became president, he brought along with him his old college buddy, Strobe Talbot. Clinton regarded Talbot as the smartest man he knew on Russia. He appointed Talbot his point man on the topic. Talbot became the Deputy Secretary of State. And apart from Clinton, actually controlled policy on Russia and the whole former Soviet Union. He had a romantic view, let's say, of Russia. It was founded in his expertise. He was an expert on the literature, on the culture, on the arts. Like a lot of us, he had that image planted in his brain of Yeltsin standing on that tank in August 1991, preventing the Soviet Union from reverting to its authoritarian past. And he projected that image into current, at that time, contemporaneous policy for Russia, for the Soviet Union. And his view was that Russia was headed inexorably to a reformist, non-threatening, pro-Western future. And furthermore, no other policy, no other place in the former Soviet Union, policy, no need, no directive in any of those republics should interfere with that future, that future that he saw. And there was a legitimate point there. Russia policy, in fact, was the most important for the region, if only for arms control. Russia itself argued it was the inheritor of the Soviet mantle. It had assumed all of the debt of the Soviet Union. It had taken all the missiles from Kazakhstan. It was the one who was most integrated with U.S. Policy to disarm. But Russia regarded itself as having taken on those liabilities, so it also deserved to take on the assets of the former Soviet Union. What were the assets? Oil fields all around the Caspian, across which Westerners were, in Russia's view, were crawling like so many ants. Talbot's view and Russia's view did not stand. It was transcended by events, and Talbot was forced to change his policy and get behind these states, put the United States behind these states as a primary U.S. foreign policy. And the way that happened was, underneath him had formed a critical mass of junior officers who had a contrary view to his own, the view being that Russia, in fact, was not, it might be headed to this future, but at the same time, its behavior was both threatening and dangerous. And the place that these officers said that it was threatening and dangerous was in this region, Caucasus and Central Asia. In 1993, Russia was responsible for the near dismemberment of Georgia. At that time, I was living there, one day a colleague from the Financial Times and I were reporting on the events when Abkhazia broke away. Anthony, your phone's ringing. Okay. Do you want to get it?
No.
Okay. My colleague came back from his reporting for the day and said how he had encountered that day Russian tanks in a field just outside of Tbilisi, west of Tbilisi. And he got to talking to the driver of one of the tanks. And he said, "Where are you guys coming from?" Well, these guys had come from Suhumi. What happened was that after the Russian-backed Abkhaz broke away from Georgia, Russia didn't want the whole state to fall apart, didn't want the whole of Georgia to fall apart, and they asked for volunteers. Who will save Georgia? And these tanks were part of this Rescue Georgia mission. The same year, I went on to Baku, and I was interviewing there a former defense minister, Leyla Yunusova, and she was complaining bitterly. Russia is helping the Armenians to fight in Nagorno-Karabakh, and you've got to do something about this. You the West. I said, "How do you know that? How do you know that the Russians are helping Armenia?" And she said, "Because they were helping us last year." Russia was not only fanning the flames of these small wars. Russia was strangling economies. At the same time, Russia cut off the natural gas supply from Turkmenistan to the West. It did the same thing with the natural gas and oil supply in Kazakhstan. It did so through this pre-Soviet. Through the Soviet era natural gas and oil pipeline system. And this, through this system, as everyone here knows, every single barrel of oil, every cubic meter of natural gas had to pass through Russia in order to be exported. And one sort of illustration of how this Russian policy worked was that meeting that some oil guys told me about in Almaty at this time. And this meeting involved all the players in an effort to build an oil field from Kazakhstan west, from up here, all the way across Russia to the Black Sea. There was the oil minister of Russia, Kazakhstan, Oman, Jim Giffen, the privateer, and John Deutsch, the privateer. And at this meeting, the Russian oil minister, Yuri Shafranik, was angry. And as the meeting proceeded, he was angrier and angrier. The Kazakh side simply wouldn't go along with the demands that Russia wanted on this pipeline. And at one point, Shafranik turned to the Kazakh oil minister and said, "Nurlan, do you mind if I borrow your mobile phone?" And he took the phone and he disappeared into one of the corners of the room. And he had this muffled conversation in the corner. Comes back to the table. A little while later, the meeting breaks up for the day. And the Kazakhs return to their office. And there, they discovered what this phone call was all about. There on the fax machine was a piece of paper, a fax. And it was from Russia. And it said, "Freak storm on the Black Sea. All oil shipments postponed for further notice." What did that mean? It meant don't mess with Russia. Well, the United States at this time decided that it was going to challenge this Russian chokehold here. And that happened. There was a turning point. And it was in 1996. Strobe Talbot and his guys were still resisting the idea of getting helping out these states. And there was one of these junior officers, Sheila Heslin. She was the director for this region on the NSC, and she got out a blank piece of paper. At this meeting was Strobe Talbot, the other deputy secretaries, and her. On this paper, she drew Central Asia and the Caucasus, and what you could see, deputies saw when they looked at this map was what you see here. This region is surrounded by countries of primary U.S. strategic importance: Iran to the south, China to the east, and Russia to the north. Heslin argued that this region, Central Asia and the Caucasus, was bound to become a battleground for influence among all of these states, and that the U.S. needed to get into that battle and win it. She argued that the West, in fact, should attempt to create a pro-Western swath of territory right through the middle of Russia and Iran, one that would be economically independent of Russia and therefore help it become politically independent of Russia. And so was born American policy getting behind this region. Talbot could not argue with that logic, and the U.S. at that time decided that it was going to get behind them, and the way that it was going to do it was to build this was to promote the construction of this pipeline, the Baku-Jehan pipeline, which came online, as everyone knows here, last year, a million barrels a day, going across 1,000 miles, and it has given political breathing space to this side of the Caspian. And it happened right in the nick of time. It coincided with Russia's reemergence on the world scene as an assertive power. It also, however, when Russia asserted itself in that way, it ushered in the current time where we are now, and I'd like to spend the the last few minutes of the talk, kind of wrapping up where we are now. Russia has shown itself to be a master of this pipeline politics. Russia has been the one to learn the lesson of this pipeline. And the lesson of the pipeline is that geopolitics and influence in that region, in that whole region, and going into Europe comes out of pipelines. It comes out of oil pipelines. It comes out of natural gas pipelines. There's this prevailing wisdom about Russia, the KGB state, that Putin's power, that Russia's power is founded in Putin's past with the KGB, and that if you understand the KGB and its mentality, then you understand Russia. I believe, and what I argue, it's not the survival of the Siloviki, the so-called Siloviki, that defines Russia. It's the survival from the Soviet period of the energy sector, Gazprom, for example, Transneft, the oil pipeline company, and that if you understand the pipelines, and that if you watch what Gazprom is doing and what Putin is doing with the pipelines, then you can get Russian policy, what's going on in Russia today, and you can understand its strategy, its geostrategy in Europe. What is Russia doing? What is Putin doing? Well, the first thing Putin is doing is he wants to harness the enormous petropower of Central Asia, bring it up into Russia, and project all of that into Europe. And his mechanism for doing this is this pipeline we've all been three pipelines, but the first one which we've been hearing about, the first one to take a new natural gas pipeline going north this way, gathering up Turkmenistan's natural gas, Kazakhstan's natural gas, and shipping it into Russia, combining it with Gazprom's, and putting it through Nord Stream into northern Europe, South Stream into southern Europe, and through this, really cutting off the Eastern Caspian without relief in sight, and increasing its current hold on the European market. 30% of Europe's natural gas and oil coming from Russia. Russia, in my view, from this 11 years that I spent down there, has established a record. It does have a record of using that petropower for its own gain, political gain and economic gain. And it behooves those states and the United States to build another pipeline to blunt that force. And that's the Trans-Caspian pipeline, which I believe really, finally, after all these years, does have a future. As everyone knows, it was cut short in the 90s because Niyazov, then the president of Turkmenistan, was demanding a $500 million bribe to put that through. He's dead now, and the new president, I believe, if provided the right kind of incentives, would get behind that line. And if he got behind the line, then I think Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan would stop being so cowardly and get behind that line too. And if an oil line were twinned with that natural gas line, then you would have Central Asia become a unit with the Caucasus, an economic unit, and in effect a political unit. And that supply, the natural gas and the oil supply to Europe, would become more diversified. And whatever leverage Russia might have gotten from the construction of that natural gas network would be blunted. I'm ready to take any questions. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve. I neglected to read the instructions for event moderators because I was so happy to see Steve. I forgot to inform people of this, so that when you do ask your questions, I want to remind you to go to the microphone to ask them. That's because the event is may be recorded for not quality control purposes, as they say on the help lines, but for broadcast on our website. And I'm also supposed to point out the emergency exits, which are out away from the terrace in that direction. So I don't know whether anyone would like to start in with some questions for Steve. It's a fascinating story. I don't know whether we have some of our in-house experts who would like to cast the first or pose the first question. You know, it was interesting. The thrust of your talk is about where the oil goes. But there's another text, a subtext in the book about where the money goes and about all of the kind of the fabulous corruption and the characters that are involved. Maybe before we get into the geopolitics, you want to talk a little bit about the money side.
Sure.
Of this. You alluded to it when you referred to Niyazov.
This is one of the, just to be completely open about it, one of the criticisms and Anthony's criticism of the book is that I don't get into this topic much, which is the oil curse. What are the states doing with the money? And I think that's a legitimate question. The oil money has created Middle East type potentates on all sides of the Caspian. The Nazarbayev family and the Aliyev family are like sultans, and their families live in that fashion. The trajectory of the corruption has gone from brown paper bags and $100 bills in suitcases to and Swiss bank accounts, which is how how Nazarbayev got caught, the Swiss bank accounts, to the formation of oil companies. And so so the first families on both sides of the Caspian have participation in local oil companies and oil transportation, especially. The Nazarbayev family is, on paper, we know, is worth at least $2.4 billion because the son-in-law and his wife are on the Forbes list, and their fortune is listed there in this one bank. I think that, just as a top line, Azerbaijan will succumb to the resource curse, and Kazakhstan, I think, will not. I think Azerbaijan is headed for a sad future, and that's because the corruption, of course, is massive, but it's massive on both sides of the Caspian. Why would one state and the other do better? One is Azerbaijan's time horizon is much shorter. Its oil fields are going to start declining in either 4 years or 8 years, between 2012 and 2016 start to decline. And that's the point at which this malady kicks in. And the Aliyev family simply did not take seriously early enough that it needed to do a Norway, invest in a stabilization fund, diversify the economy, and it's simply too late, and that place, you know, just imagine, you know, put it together yourselves. What does that mean, you know, a future starting maybe 10 years from now, maybe 15, maybe 20, but an economic decline and all of the things that go with that. On the Kazakhstan side, conversely, they've got oil as far as the eye can see. The Kashagan oil field, the biggest oil field found in anywhere in the world in 3 or 4 decades, isn't even going to start producing oil until 2010 and or 2012. They haven't finished exploring the rest of that Caspian shelf. There is the possibility and even the probability of a few more giant and even super giant fields there. This means they have much more room for error, for sin. But apart from that, Nazarbayev has done a better job at spreading around the wealth. The clan that's sharing the spoils is much larger. Maybe there's some difference between how the Central Asians and the Caucasus peoples deal with money. I don't know, but you can see that Kazakhstan really has a potential for averting that curse and having a very broad-based economy going forward.
That begins to get at it, and I think a couple of other things. I mean, that your presentation is very focused on current fears about Russia, and obviously the story of the Caucasus in Central Asia during the period that your book covers is one about these countries trying to struggle out from under Russia's shadow. But in the meantime, other countries no less interesting and vital for U.S. strategic interests, like China and Iran, also were part of the thinking in the 1990s about these alternative pipelines. They wanted the oil to go anywhere but through Iran. And today, one of the reasons why we we're living with oil futures at $100 a barrel is because of a not so poorly founded fear that the United States could be heading towards a military conflict with the Iranians. So I wonder if you want to talk a little bit, because the Caspian, they've just had a big conference there. You can talk about Iran a little bit and China and how they play in your geoeconomic picture.
Yeah. I keep forgetting to talk about China, and then but smart people raise it. China, in effect, is an ally of the United States in Central Asia and the Caucasus. This is not spoken. Whoops, I've shrunk.
Pull it up. There you go.
Okay. What's the objective here? The objective is to help Caucasus in Central Asia become to give them political breathing space so that they can be genuinely independent. So what's the difference if the oil and natural gas goes east or goes west? There is no difference. And so if China actually does build these couple of pipelines that they're suggesting, which I don't believe they will, but if they did, you have the same result. Why do I think of, you know, China is proposing a natural gas pipeline out of Turkmenistan, and again they've signed these contracts. These are for those who have watched this place, they sign contracts, you know, like they go to dinner. I mean, they really, it doesn't mean anything. And really the way to evaluate whether a pipeline is actually going to happen is when the steel arrives on the ground. They've ordered it and it's actually shipped, and you can see it. You know, there, the 1990s, the famous Unocal pipeline going through Afghanistan. The presidents of Pakistan, Afghanistan, all the Central Asia states, Iran, stood in the desert with a pipeline and inaugurated the beginning of the construction of this pipeline that was going to carry Turkmen natural gas across Afghanistan into Pakistan and perhaps on into India. Well, that pipeline is still sitting in the desert all by itself. And it didn't matter how many treaties were signed and how many Western companies were involved in that line. A month ago, has it already been a month since the Tehran conference, or 3 weeks?
Within that frame.
The presidents of the Central Asia republics and Putin and Ahmadinejad sat in Tehran for this Tehran conference discussing this perennial issue of dividing up the Caspian Sea. And how are they going to divide it up? Well, this is the ongoing red herring. This is this alliance between Russia and Iran to insinuate themselves onto the Caspian Sea, into the oil deals, how decisions are made, by foisting this abstract discussion: is the Caspian a lake or a sea? And as usual, you know, they all agree on it. Yes, we must decide this issue. Definitely, we really must decide this issue. And then they all go home, and then they don't decide it, because it's to no one's benefit. It's not to the benefit of the three stands there. They want to develop their offshore fields. They may want to build that Trans-Caspian pipeline. If every state around the around that sea has the right to veto that, to veto these installations, then obviously they can't be built. And it's not to Russia's and Iran's benefit to settle it, because they do want to stop the construction of these. So they just agree to disagree. But just to come to a point on that, Central Asia states, Russia, are not allies of Iran. This is an alliance of convenience. They use this as a way to have a big tribune. Putin being kind of an outcast, Ahmadinejad being kind of an outcast, when they get together, they can attract attention. And so they get together and they make pronouncements on the Caspian Sea, on pipelines, and on nuclear issues. In fact, the people here who are from the former Soviet Union know the local people are very suspicious of Iran, and it really is it's a thing of convenience.
Thanks, Steve. I'd like to just, if you identify yourself also, and then pose your question.
Okay, my name's Ellie Hearn, and I'm from the United Nations Association of the USA, My question might be slightly off topic, but I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on it. I just wondered, with the increasing emphasis on climate change, do you think this will have, well, what impact do you think this will have, if any, on Russia and China's power kind of derived through fossil fuels? And, you know, you say that China signs these sorts of contracts, you know, as they go to dinner, like, very often, and I just wondered if you think it will affect their influence.
The short answer is long term. It's a long term question, and it involves really the whole future of the oil industry. And the oil industry is in a decline. It looks like it's huge, $9 billion quarters, $10 billion quarters, but because of the structure of the industry today, in which national oil companies and ministries control 80 or 90% of the resources around the world now, oil and natural gas, the big oil companies are on the decline, and in the next two decades, you're going to see them become much different, either disappear or become much different beings. But what does this do? This incentivizes them to do something to survive. And what might they do? Exxon is famous for its 30-year timeline. Every single year, the executives of Exxon, the top executives, go into their boardrooms and they make their strategy based on this 30-year timeline. Now, they don't come out and tell us what they decided, but I can bet you if I'm aware of this, if Business Week is aware of it, and whoever else has called this future, Exxon is aware of this, and it is furiously working in its laboratory to come up with the equivalent of the transistor. This is the oil industry twinning with the green movement to sometime down the line in the future decades to produce some evolutionary invention that makes obsolete fossil fuels. And so when that happens, you know, whoever invents that thing is going to be the Bill Gates of the energy industry. And just coming to a loop back to your question, the power of China and the petrostates that will become powerful before that happens, Venezuela, Iran, China, Russia, their influence will decline.
Thank you.
You can lower them.
Yeah. Sorry. Thank you. I'm Rachel. I'm from OSI. I just wanted to ask, given your predictions for Azerbaijan and how it will be kind of succumbing to this resource curse, how do you see that influencing the building of the possible pipeline and long-term kind of political outcomes from that?
And Steve, in answering Rachel's question, the casual listener might confuse an oil pipeline and a gas pipeline. And so maybe you want to talk a little bit about some of the pipelines that we're looking at are gas and some of them oil, and you can't just turn off oil one minute and start pushing gas in it. So maybe in answering that, give a little more information.
Yeah. There is a one possible future for Azerbaijan that could keep it from just plunging into the abyss is a future as a hub, an energy hub equivalent to the way that Dubai, the Emirates, are transport hubs, banking hubs. And Baku could serve just to put a topic sentence on top. I don't see Azerbaijan's problem with the resource curse as undermining the future of a pipeline. I see it the opposite way. It is a life raft or whatever, a life preserver for Azerbaijan as a transportation hub if this natural gas pipeline, this yellow one here, materializes, which I have a hunch that it's going to materialize. It doesn't look like it, but this is my feeling. Then you've got Baku serving as that hub, and if a oil pipeline, again, if an oil pipeline is twinned with that, you've got the makings of that type of industry there, which isn't the kind of money that you've got with oil by any means, but it is some form of income stream.
Talk about the difference, the oil and the gas. Well, because some of these pipelines were just built for, BTC is built with oil
right
in mind.
Okay. But I'm not sure I'm not sure what you're getting to because, yeah, Baku-Jehan is an oil pipeline, but there's a natural gas pipeline twinned with it that goes into Turkey. In general, the folks who are designing the routes are trying to have twin lines.
Okay.
Elena Harold, I'm with PFC Energy. Just a little comment about this Trans-Caspian pipeline. It doesn't seem that it will materialize because
if you could speak up a little louder.
Trans-Caspian pipeline, you said you believe in that. It's good to believe in things, but at this moment, and we are a consulting company in energy, and I'm working for Global Gas Group, doesn't seem to be economic to begin with. Plus, as you just noticed, there is another pipeline that was built basically under the West, the good West influence, the twin pipeline to BTC, which was uneconomic, but it was built despite of that, because, again, the West wanted Central Asia to diversify from Russia. Well, my question is, what's the difference between bad Russia's influence in the Central Asia and in those stands and good West's influence? I mean, do you believe that the West, and I believe West means U.S. basically, has just a goodwill, like charity kind of intentions, and Russia is all bad and, you know, greed and just the difference. What do you think? Because, well, thank you for your presentation. It's interesting, but it was a little bit black and white. I think if I read the book, and I will read the book, I guess it will be more colorful. I hope so, because, you know, this stand between Russia and the West now becomes worse and worse because of this kind of black and white analysis on both sides. And it doesn't lead anywhere good, you know. So, just your thoughts.
Yeah. This is a good question. I don't see bad Russia and good West. What I see is that is a situation of monopoly and non-monopoly. These states, over the last 15 years, but particularly in the first 10 or 11 years, had a monopoly sales situation with Russia. And Russia used this situation, this monopsony power over these states to achieve certain goals that it wanted in that region. The what I saw in the 11 years that I was based there was repeated use of cutting off the access of Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan especially, but also Georgia and Azerbaijan to natural gas and then to be able to export natural gas and oil. This power to control a country's economic lifeline it's not saying that someone is evil. It is an economic law that is valid in any industry, anywhere in the world, any country, and the opportunity to eliminate that monopoly is something that's a positive thing. It's an obvious and valid aim to have, something that that confers onto the recipient of it, meaning these states, economic breathing room and political breathing room. It does not tie these states in a monopolistic or powerful basis to the West. On the contrary, it simply provides breathing room for these states. Just again to wrap that up, I want to be clear that I'm challenged in these states to think of a positive thing that Russia, Gazprom, Transneft, Lukoil did for these states with that monopoly power, with that monopsony power. Maybe you can name one. I see it the opposite way, and I think the record shows it's the opposite. And the having a balance, meaning another pipeline route out, is a positive development.
If you want to respond, please do, but just do it at the mic.
Russia depends on Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan gas now more than the opposite way.
For consumption.
Yeah, to fulfill their obligations, both domestic right. market and exports. So, and this pipeline that you said, the new pipeline from Turkmenistan through Kazakhstan, pre-Caspian, it's called in Russian. It's not actually a new pipeline that they're talking about building. It's reviving the pipeline that existed, Central Asia Center 3. There is that line. It just has to be upgraded, expanded. That's all. And that's more economic than to build completely new pipeline under sea, Caspian. And Russia is paying now $100 per thousand mm-hmm. cubic meters. And Turkmenistan just started building pipeline to China, and Chinese promised to pay 100 as well in the future. And with Chinese, you never know, because again, when the pipeline is built, they are stuck with that. So there will be another negotiation or whatever. And with Russians, they already pay 100, and Turkmenistan now doesn't even want to go next year for 100. They ask for 150. So now who is challenging whom, actually? It's, and who depends on whom? You know, Russia needs gas for its obligations to fulfill them.
Yeah, so. Let me just reply to that, because I didn't in fact answer one part of your previous question involved the viability of a Trans-Caspian pipeline. It is true that Russia, its European supply policy, in fact, relies on Turkmen gas, and that's why it's trying to tie up the supply. I just I don't think it's valid that it's not valid as an economic model to have a monopoly situation. You're just not going to persuade me of that. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now, why would a Trans-Caspian pipeline work? One, I don't. That pipeline, the one going to the north, that's been signed by Putin and all the other leaders. That could happen. But again, I won't believe it until the steel arrives on the ground, and a Trans-Caspian pipeline would. It depends what facts you put into your economic equation. If you exclude the monopoly, then yeah, then of course, then maybe you can say it's cheaper. But if you include the cost of not having economic leverage, then building that insurance policy, a diversified pipeline across the sea, could and I think would end up being as economic. And as I say, I think it's going to be built.
Okay, we have another question.
Hi, my name's Joseph Fallon. With regard to the benefits of diversification, could you comment on the proposed Iranian-Georgia pipeline and the Iranian-Pakistan-Indian pipeline, both of which the U.S. government vehemently opposes?
Let me say it again.
There was a proposal for Georgia and Iran, as well as Iran, Pakistan, and India pipelines.
Yeah.
These would be diversifications. These are both vehemently opposed by the U.S. government.
Yeah. I just think, for the reason you just stated, they're just not going to happen. I mean, it's intractable antagonism between Iran and the United States, basically. One can argue, going straight south through Iran would be great, and then also connecting Pakistan and India, a peace pipeline. This is great on paper. During the 90s, as you know, people argued, why doesn't Baku Jehan get built between Azerbaijan and Armenia as a peace pipeline? These are things that look great on paper, but they don't happen because of the real politics on the ground. So I just don't see that happening.
But aren't you in the same, if I may follow up, if you're interested in having an independent Central Asia, Georgia wants its independence, but the U.S. says no, it's not in our interest. So you're criticizing Russia with regard to its monopoly tendencies in Central Asia, but you're giving the same arguments to justify, not necessarily monopoly, but power politics of the U.S. It doesn't benefit Georgia. It does benefit Georgia, but it doesn't benefit the U.S., so that's okay not to have that pipeline. Pakistan and India would benefit them. The same principle that you would apply to Central Asia, you're only not to apply to Georgia or India. And that's where I'm seeing a discrepancy here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm not arguing what should be, what I'm arguing what I think will be, what I think will happen. All I'm telling you, I'm not saying that that a pipeline through Iran should not happen. Should the West, should the United States find common ground with Iran? Yes. Should there be a pipeline built straight south? Yes. Should Iran's natural gas be sent west through Pakistan and to India? Yes. Do I think any of these are going to happen? No. I just don't think they will. We can't even make peace with Cuba. I disagree. You said the U.S. opposes Georgian independence. I think that's false.
Last year at Columbia, there was the discussion about these various pipelines, one, of course, Georgia. And it was stated how it would be economic beneficial to Georgia, increase its independence, its diversification, all the things you're talking about being benefits to Central Asia, and how the U.S. opposed that pipeline for those reasons.
It opposed. I mean, I don't know about this discussion you guys had up there, but when the U.S. From the Clinton administration forward, had its anti-Iran policy. It's an anti-Iran policy. It doesn't have a relationship to Georgia at all. It wouldn't matter if the pipeline were from, I mean, name your country. You know, it's just the U.S. has had this policy of not opposing installations, you know, like pipelines and so forth, in Iran. And whether you support it or whether I support it or anyone thinks that Bush ought to make peace with or his successor with Ahmadinejad or his successor, this is besides the point. You know, it's just there's no sign that that's going to happen. I'm just, you know, if your intention is to speak about what should happen, say, okay, yes, but what will happen? Not that.
I understand.
I see a
discrepancy between your. I don't see a difference between your position about this, and yet you're opposing Russia for doing the same thing essentially in Central Asia.
I think the point's been made, and so we're just going to keep on going. Joel,
you talked in some detail about Strobe Talbot. Can you say anything analogous or continuing the story with regard to the current administration? Namely, who is doing what in terms of policy?
The policy has since the policy shifted. The 1996. It's basically gone forward. The last time I examined it closely was in the energy policy, the famous energy policy that Cheney released, and it was virtually identical to the Clinton era policy. One difference I see that I think is really positive is that the U.S. has been willing to directly challenge challenge Karimov. The willingness to fly out those survivors of the Andijan massacre, and the willing just to cut, I mean, knowing that was going to result in a cut off of the relationship, really, they went forward with it, and I regard the alliance that the U.S. formed with Uzbekistan in 1995 based on the military-to-military relationship as a negative development. And this is the language that Karimov understands.
To supplement Steve's answer, the biggest development in the region in the past several years in the energy context has been with the demise of President Niyazov, his successor, Berdi Muhammadov, coming to power and instigating a period of greater economic openness, meaning receptivity, in fact, invoking a kind of a second great game, but on a smaller scale around Turkmenistan's natural gas resources. And just this year, I believe, you know, various delegates, there have been at least, I understand, 15 delegations from Washington going out, trying to, again, push the interests of U.S. energy companies. The Europeans, the Russians, and the Chinese have been no less interested. Up to date, that Turkmenistan's gas reserves are kind of on the market,
they're up for grabs. That's really the biggest thing that's happening. And it's interesting that some of the personalities who were involved in the mid-90s with this in the Caspian, like Steve Mann, who was an energy czar back in the day and was U.S. ambassador to Turkmenistan, is now back in this role again. But U.S. is quite focused on this question still. It's interesting when I said in the beginning that when OSI looked at this issue, we were maxed out in the 90s about conversations about where would the oil go and looking at it in power terms. But our mission is about promoting open societies, social development. And, of course, there's an aspect which you've been challenged on a little bit, that saying that, you know, doing energy deals with Russia would kind of leave these countries dependent on Moscow and on a kind of way of doing business politically that would leave them less well off, those societies, in terms of questions of governance. So when we looked at the situation in the Caspian Basin in the mid-90s, we said rather than be concerned with where the oil goes and where the pipelines run, we wanted to see more about how we could use the environment of discussion about the region's energy resources to develop programs that would put public finance in the spotlight and in the center of debate in places like Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. And again, I don't know the extent to which it's dealt with in the book, because, you know, it's a big book. But from what I was able to study in the book, I didn't see as much discussion about this issue, that with the major oil developments in the Caspian, all of which, if taken together, are probably about the size of Angola in terms of what it means for the spot market. But the big deals in the mid-90s in the Caspian and in West Africa have brought forth a major international movement for transparency in these countries, which is more grassroots driven. But it's also been met with by international support, the formation of this Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, which was led by Western governments, but which is now endorsed by the G8 regularly. There have been, you know, creation of movements in these countries as well, of citizens that want to put, because they realize maybe the money that's already been diverted is lost to them, but they want to set a kind of tone in their countries where accountability and transparency are the norm in these dealings, and it's worked, you know, to better or worse effect, depending on which country. But so there is some, you know, you read a book like this and you feel the sense, great sense of injustice. You know, you get to the end of the story and there's been fabulous fortunes made or plundered. None of the people who gave or took the bribe seem to have been brought to justice. The countries which played rough won, and societies seem to have lost out. But, I mean, do you see any prospect for example, Giffen, who you spend a lot of time using your sharp journalistic pen, you know, portraying for his kind of flamboyant style and his cowboy methods like the others, Joyce and so on. Do you see that this trial that he's been embroiled in here in the U.S. is ever going to resolve in such a way as to give people who are concerned about corruption a sense of closure and justice? And do you see for these societies that, in addition to the material side, there will also be any kind of greater transparency that will emerge in them as a result of having gone through this international competition over the resources?
Yeah. The book does not reply to this. It gets what happened in all of these oil deals. How it gets you inside the rooms. How everything was decided. How they really happened. And so any mystery of how we got from there to here is sort of removed. And I'm glad that it's that at least with you it then provokes questions. And I think you should write the companion volume that answers them.
I don't think it would sell any copies. That's not as much as yours. And by the way, everyone's supposed to leave here and go out and buy this.
Okay, let me say.
But seriously.
Yeah.
Talk about where the Giffen case.
Yeah, Giffen. Giffen is accused of funneling about $80 million in payments from the American oil companies to the president of Kazakhstan and his cronies. The case has been going on for 3.5 years. Giffen's defense is that he was a asset for the CIA the whole time. And that, therefore, he believed that whatever he was doing was approved of, sanctioned by the U.S. government, so that he was okay. He hasn't challenged the actual details in the indictment of the tracking of the money through the bank accounts and on to Nazarbayev's Swiss accounts and some other officials. Well, I'll tell you, I've believed until recently that eventually that case was going to go to court, and that what you were going to have in effect was a trial of Nazarbayev as the recipient of the money. If Giffen were convicted, since he took money from one place and gave it to another, the charge is foreign bribery, and the recipient is Nazarbayev, then you have, you know, facts on the record in a courtroom with that result. Recently, I've spoken with some people who I think are smart, and they think that that this case is not going to go on trial sometime soon, during the Bush administration, that it's another one of these issues that's being held over until 2009, and as evidence of this, in the first three years of the proceedings in court, the hearings they would hold, you would see the judge and the prosecution publicly, in a very assertive way, making it clear that they wanted this case to go forward. They wanted it to be tried as soon as possible, particularly the judge. The last two hearings were postponed, were not held, and no more statements from the judge. I insist that both sides get their acts together, come to an agreement on what documents are going to be are going to be allowed in court and what are not, and let's hold this trial at the earliest possible moment. He's not saying that any. The prosecution is not saying that anymore, and so one wonders what's going on here, and it kind of resembles some other cases where you've seen the Justice Department, you know, from up high, kind of meddling in a case. And then as regards to the last part of your question regarding transparency, I can't see any future of there being transparency. Why would there be transparency in Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan? Maybe when Azerbaijan has already lost everything, when it's on the decline, and when it's somehow in its benefit to suddenly say, "Hey, we're clean," you know, then, yeah.
I think the leaving Giffen aside on the transparency question, this book talks about a lot of situations where there was a need, if there'd been more transparency, say, between the oil companies and their agents and the national governments, it would have been, you would have avoided a lot of these unfortunate episodes. The transparency movement has, in effect, focused so much attention on that that I think that the venue for corruption has moved downstream. Now, you know, first of all, you know, any deals that take place, both Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan have joined the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, or are candidates. They're preparing reports that will be independently audited about their dealings with foreign oil companies. Then, as you said, then there's the whole question about national oil companies. If you go to Baku today, I was just there a month ago, and it's an incredible construction boom. So, you know, you don't need to be a genius to figure out that, you know, maybe not all of those buildings that are being built are needed. Maybe there's some money changing hands in the construction industry. Surprise, surprise. But the dirty deals are not necessarily going on between foreign oil companies, IOCs, and national governments. I think it's moved downstream. So maybe the problem, I think the problem has been addressed in one area, and people understand there's new rules of the road in that area, and the governments maybe are finding other strategies, or other people who have impure objectives have found other strategies for earning illicit money off of these deals. But it's moved as a result of this process somewhere else. But in the process, public awareness has been raised about it, and you read a debate in the papers and on television today about it that you didn't see 10 years ago. That's the
you are a very optimistic man.
That's what I get paid for.
Yeah, no. I think the money. I think that the corruption, the small fry corruption, has moved downstream in. Kazakhstan has the same, I shouldn't say small fry, but Nazarbayev's youngest daughter is the chief recipient of the construction deals in Kazakhstan, for example. But Timur Kulibayev, the son-in-law, is the key oil man in Kazakhstan. What does it mean when Kazakhstan says that all future oil deals in the offshore must be controlled 50% by the government, by Kazmoon, I guess? When Eurasia and Almex, the two front companies for Kulibayev, are partners either publicly or behind the scenes in the in a lot of the smaller and medium sized domestic oil deals, it means that corruption. It's insider dealing that's downstream, mm-hmm. and it's upstream, all the way upstream, and so
up to the international level.
Well, meaning there haven't been any big oil deals done since. I mean, on either side since then. Let's see what happens when the offshore is finally done in Kazakhstan. I'll just be floored if what you say is true, you know, that you know, these deals are transparent and don't involve the first families.
Yeah, I think it'd be great to have a experienced, knowledgeable, investigative journalist pro like yourself following that story.
Why are you buttering me up?
Because it's time to wind up.
Okay.
And I'm trying to think of something nice. No, I think that with your background and your skepticism, I'm very happy to see you try and get in for the final big deals of the Caspian and see whether this hypothesis is true, if there is big money still changing hands from international oil companies and the national oil companies, national governments. My sense is that that area has probably been substantially cleaned up over the past 10 years. Does it mean that human nature has been altered? No. But, Steve, your book is sharp and provocative as the presentation was today. I urge people to go out and read it, and then we hope it's not another number of years before we see you back here again. I think we're going to leave it at there. Thank you, Steve, very much.
Thanks for coming.